What's up, everyone? You're listening to the Budgets and Brews podcast with your host, Rich and Tony, where we discuss, chat, and ramble about personal finance, investing, getting out of debt, budgets, business, and beer. This week's topic is Live for Free, House Hacking 101. In this episode, we interview Andrew Kerr and discuss the basics of house hacking, what that entails, and how you can live for free. At the end of the episode, join us for Rich and Tony's Beer Review, where we act like beer connoisseurs, but in reality have no idea what we're talking about. Today on tap is Blue Moon Belgium White. All right, welcome, Andrew. We're happy to have you on the show today. How's it going?
You know, I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me on, man. I love getting on podcasts and talking with folks about everything, you know, money, personal finance related. So thanks again for having me on.
Yes, and we enjoy doing it, and that's why we're here today. So would you be able to provide listeners with a brief background of your experience and anything you want to share to help us get to know you better? I have a little bit of on you, 6 years in the mortgage banking industry, working in nonprofit, doing disaster response, raising money for investors, flipping homes, joint ventures, a real estate portfolio of over 40 units, and you have done large syndications. And that's like if you're thinking apartment complexes with 30, 40, 50 doors. That's a lot, but what else do you got for us?
Yeah, man. That definitely sounds like a lot. So, you know, I was that kid in high school that if I liked the class, I got an A. If I didn't like the class or didn't like the teacher, I got a D. I did just enough to get by. Didn't go to college, and then I started working right away, you know, as soon as I got out of high school. And what I ended up doing was falling into the mortgage banking industry at 19. By 20, I had bought my first house, and I just liked that idea of going out hustling and working. The idea of spending 4 years in college just didn't make sense for me at that time. You know, that ended up having that six and a half year career in the mortgage banking industry, and that was early on, was just this very consumer mindset. Like, I needed to go get a Porsche. I needed to, you know, make so much money that I could fly on a private jet. Never got to that point, but that's sort of that lifestyle, was like chasing everything materialistic, didn't save well, didn't really invest well. And then, you know, making good money, hated life. A sort of short summer vacation ended up having me in the nonprofit sector as a volunteer. Completely changed my world. It's how I met my wife. But then all of a sudden I went from making six figures to, you know, my starting salary in the nonprofit sector was an $800 a month stipend. So I quickly realized, you know, this is awesome. I love life now, but I'm not making money. How do I get ahead financially so I can do what I love, and mastering personal finances, investing in real estate, and then investing outside of real estate was that answer for me.
Yeah. And what I love about that is, you alluded to, you didn't go to college, you didn't graduate. And there's a huge debate out there. Do I have to go to college? Can I be successful without that degree, without that education? Are there alternative routes? And that's what I love about this story, your story, and what we're going to be sharing today is something where you can supplement this for an education if you want to. You can expand on this and make it into a program, a bachelor's and whatnot, when you're starting to dive into real estate investing and like the nuances of that, even commercial investing as well. But one of the topics we're going to start on is house hacking, because that's what this show is going to be about right now. What is that? What does that term mean?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of definitions out there. The way I like to just oversimplify it is, house hacking is just making a slightly different choice with your housing, so that way where you're living is generating some sort of income to let you offset your costs. So like right now in the US, I think the average two bedroom apartment rents for $1,200-$1,300 a month. The average mortgage payment, you know, pre-taxes, insurance, is a little over $1,000 a month. For most folks, they spend around a third of their budget on housing, and housing is their single biggest line item. So the idea is, can we do something to help reduce or completely eliminate that? And that's what house hacking is to me.
We took a lot of this from the article that you wrote, and we're going to go ahead and link that in our show notes. But what variations do you have of that house hacking? I think you listed about six of them in there. And could you sort of elaborate on each of those?
Yeah, I'll run through them really quick. And you know, this is just sort of this broad idea, and then there's so many different variations to do it. So there's the roommate style of house hacking, income suite, the ADU or accessory dwelling unit, the small multifamily, work provided house hacking, and then this live-in flip. So this idea with the roommate is, Tony, you know, you're getting ready to graduate college here in another couple of years, and you're used to living with roommates. So it's like, well, why don't I just go buy a single family house, and then I rent out, you know, buy a four-bedroom house, I'll rent out the other three rooms to my buddies. Now, all of a sudden, what you're collecting in rent, they're paying cheaper rent than if they were to just go get an apartment on their own, and they're covering your complete mortgage payment. You know, that's house hacking right there. The income suite is where maybe you've got that mother-in-law suite or that furnished walkout basement that you can now rent that out to family, friend, college student, someone else. The ADU accessory dwelling unit is, you know, think about that like pool house, guest house, or that garage apartment detached building. So in the U.S., that an ADU is the technical sort of term for that type of building. Multifamily, most folks are familiar with. It's that duplex, triplex, or fourplex. You live in one unit, you rent out the others. You know, this work provided one is one we really started pushing is, and it's not really for everyone, but there's a lot of job opportunities out there where they'll actually give you a housing allowance. You know, the biggest one is military. So you get your base pay in the military, and it's not really that great. You know, most folks will get $20,000 a year starting out in the military, but they get a housing allowance. You know, we interviewed a guy that's in the military, was in San Diego. His housing allowance was $3,000 a month. So it's pretty crazy. So the idea is, could you pick a, if you're making a career choice, could you pick a career where they give you a housing allowance or a corporate apartment? And then the last way is this live and flip, where you're buying a house, you're going to live in it for 2 years, really fix it up. It needs a ton of work. And then after that, you sell it, and you have this big profit, which then offsets your costs over that past 2 years. So those are the six sort of main styles. And then there's a lot of other cool creative things where, like, you know, people will rent out the parking pad on the side of their house where a neighbor could park their big RV, so it's not on the street. So there's a lot of creative things too you can throw in there.
And a couple of these, it resonates with me really well. One, I have I guess it's a work provided housing. So I'm a resident director. So living on campus, one of the positions where they give me an apartment, it's two bedroom, two bath, it's got a kitchen, living room, and I don't have to pay rent at all or my utility. My utilities are included, my internet. It's great. I'm also in higher education. I see a lot of that as well, depending like the higher up you go, provost, director of residence life, even faculty, sometimes visiting faculty members, they will provide them with housing options, which is great. And then just like you said, with the military, my buddy lives in Colorado and I think he gets like a little over $2,000 for his housing allowance. And going back to another one, my grandma lived with me for the longest time in, I guess it would be the ADU unit, where she had a whole upstairs. It was an additional unit that was attached with stairs, door. It had a kitchen, bath, living room, bedroom, everything up there. So it's like I'm reading through this article and I'm pulling these things. I'm like, oh, I've actually lived a couple of these.
You've been house hacking, yeah. And I mean, that's the whole thing is, right, is like, you know, the typical mindset is, all right, I get out of school, I go buy a house, or maybe I rent for a bit, and then I get serious with a partner, and then we buy a house, and then, you know, time goes on. But could you look at just a creative choice with your housing to offset part or all of your housing costs? And this isn't something you have to do forever, right? It's like, could we do this for 3 years or 5 years when we're just out of college to rapidly pay down our debt? Or maybe you're just getting engaged, you're getting ready to start your life together with your significant other. Instead of going for that traditional route of buying a big single family house that you'll grow into, could you house hack for 3, 4, 5 years to set yourself up financially? And then when you go to start the family, buy the more traditional house. And that 3 to 5 years of doing that house hack and having no housing costs can just set your life up financially.
Yeah. And the next question that we have on here, and it sort of has already been answered, but is why should you consider house hacking?
Yeah, it's really just to help accelerate whatever your financial goals are. So if you're trying to get out of debt, if you can reduce or eliminate your housing costs, now how quickly could you pay off your debt if you freed up an extra $500,000 a month or more? Or maybe you're trying to save, you say, you know what, we're maxing out our retirement accounts. You know, we got a little debt, we're okay, but we really want to make sure our kids can go to a great college. Well, what if you house hack for the first 5 years of their life and you put $1,000 a month away? By the time they get to college age, that's a pretty awesome college savings for them. So you just got to really figure out your why and then use it to accelerate your financial goals.
Yeah, one other thing I like about the house hacking is when everyone talks about, you know, I'm going to save my money, or I'm shooting to retire early, or I'm looking for financial freedom, the topic is always brought up, you know, you got to cut back on the little things, right? You know, start shopping at Walmart and you know, don't go out as much and don't drink at the bars and don't have fun. But as you mentioned, Andrew, like housing is typically the largest line item or expense that people face, you know, in their everyday life. And if you can really drastically reduce that expense for yourself, that's really going to make a larger impact and you don't have to focus on the little things as much.
Yeah. I mean, that what was that old saying? Like, you know, that $5 cup of coffee a day is going to, you know, keep you from retiring. In reality, it's not. That $5 a day, you know, it's $100 a month. That barely makes a dent when you look at your $1,000, $1,500 a month you're spending on housing. So, you know, you cut that in half, you know, now you're saving $500, $600, $700, $800 a month. That's going to make a dent where that $5 cup of coffee isn't. I mean, you should still try to take control of some of those basic things just to build some good financial practices, but tackling your biggest expense is what's going to help you really get ahead.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the average 1/3 of our salaries or our pay goes towards that. And I think those smaller, if you want to focus on the coffees, if you want to cut the subscriptions that you have for TV, all those are bonus, right? Those could add up and even add more to that. So you're saving and you're hitting whatever your goals are, like you said.
Well, if you're trying to get a spouse or a partner on board and they're, say, maybe they're against budgeting or being frugal, is it going to be easier to say, hey, we can still go out to eat once a week. You can still have your morning cup of coffee. But if you have that fun stuff, can we just buy a duplex instead of a single family and live in that for 4 or 5 years? That could end up being an easier sell versus like, oh, we're going to move from a 2-bedroom apartment to a 2-bedroom duplex. Okay, that's not that big of a change. Now I don't have to give up that stuff. So it's an easy way to help get a partner on board.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest concerns I think I even had with this or when I'm talking to people, because they assume, well, if I have an apartment, I don't want someone just renting that other room out. That's a lack of privacy. But looking at this, there's so many different options that you have available to you where you can still keep your privacy as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, house hacking, and this is why I started pushing a lot of articles out on house hacking. We have tons of case studies of showing more folks. It's just not for that young person getting out of college and that wants 4, 5, 6 roommates. You know, you can do this as a young couple. You can do this with a family. And there's so many cool options out there where you can still have your privacy. You know, my wife and I, our third house hack was this big building that we converted into apartments. I mean, we were in a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom, sort of a small space, but we had original hardwood floors. It was like $20 square foot marble in the bathroom. It's like a 60-gallon jacuzzi soaker tub. We had the farmhouse sink. And then our fourth house hack, we moved from that 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom to a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom fenced-in yard. We're in a great location in New Orleans. You know, we can almost walk to the French Quarter. My favorite barbecue place is right down the street. So house hacking doesn't have to be a sacrifice. You just got to find the style that really fits well for you and your situation. And then you can change that over the period of your life.
And you offer a house hacking a quick start guide. How can listeners get a copy of that and what does it entail?
Yeah, so I'll give you guys a link so you can put it in your show notes. It's fibyrei.com/hhstart. You can just go and grab a copy of that. We just cover the 6 main steps to doing a house hack. So it's like picking your style, going through finding your team, and then just a couple little things to think about to help get you on the track towards thinking about actually doing a house hack.
But also in that blog post, you did write and talk about the numbers of house hacking. And specifically, you mentioned the 1% rule. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. So in the real estate investing world, and we're going to dive deep a little bit into real estate investing. So I just want folks that are listening, if you're doing a house hack, you don't have to go be a real estate investor. If you have no desire to be a real estate investor, you could do a house hack for a short period of time just to help get you ahead financially and then never do another real estate investment again. So let me just add that little disclaimer. But the idea with the 1% rule is it's a rule of thumb in real estate investing that says, hey, a property, if I'm buying a property for, let's say, $100,000, it should get to about $1,000 in rent. Now, if you're going to be house hacking, there's some different things in here. So I'm talking with this one guy right now that's trying to do a house hack. He's renting a place in Florida. He's paying $1,800 a month in rent. He's looking at a house hack. It's going to cost about $400,000. It's a duplex, and it's only going to bring in about, if you're to rent both sides, about $3,500 a month. So that $3,500 a month, a purchase price of $400,000, doesn't meet the 1% rule. But when he moves in and rents out the other side, his housing costs all of a sudden drop to about $600 a month. So it doesn't meet that 1% rule of thumb, but helps him save over $1,000 a month. So with house hacking, you can break that rule a little bit if you plan on selling the house when you're done and not turning it into a long-term investment. But yeah, the 1% rule is just this rule of thumb that a property should rent for about the purchase price, 1% of the purchase price. Yeah.
And I think that's a great rule, especially when someone's looking into this and they're like, how do I know if I'm getting a good deal? How do I know if this has been beneficial to me? And I think that's a good starting point, good guide. Now, what are some different affordable financing options someone might have when they're starting off in this? Maybe they haven't bought a home yet, or they're about to move out of college and get their first apartment or rental. I know you talk about three, but can you talk about the differences between those? And those were the FHA loans, VA loans, and conventional loans.
Yeah, so there's the conventional HomePath loan. There's FHA, VA, and then there's two other sort of good ones out there. It's the USDA Rural Loan and then the NACA. It's an affordable loan. So, you know, the conventional HomePath loan, you only need to put 5% down. FHA is 3.5% down. So, you know, if you're buying a $200,000 home with an FHA, you got to come up with $7,000. And at first, $7,000 seems like a lot of money. But once you're sort of early in your career, you start working, most folks are getting $2,000-$3,000 back as a tax return. So save that for 2 years, plus cut out some other small stuff, and now you've got your down payment. The VA loan is specifically for veterans. So if you're in the military or you served in the military, you can qualify for that VA loan, 0% down payment. So it's just another great affordable option. The USDA loan is if you're sort of is really based on a population size of the town that you're in. So if you're in a big city, it doesn't work for you, but you're more in the suburbs or rural, it's a really great option that was developed to help provide affordable housing options for folks that are in that more rural area. And then the NACA loan is a great affordable option for if you're sort of that low to income bracket and you're in a city. It's a really affordable option. You don't have to have amazing credit, and there's essentially 0% down payment options on those. So there's really sort of five good options out there for low to no down payment options to buy a home. And this is the advantage with house hacking, right? So if I were to go buy an investment property as an investor, I'm having to put 20 to 25% down. So on that $200,000 example, you know, I'm coming up with $40,000 to $50,000. But if you were to go buy that same property as a house hack and you're going to live in it, now you can buy it with anywhere from 0 to 5% down. Makes a huge difference for getting into a property.
What happens when there's a property, like let's say it's a house. They bought a house and they have it. Can you build additionally on that property if I wanted to build something in the back? Or do you have to have that zoned, or how do you comply with the city?
Yeah, so you got to check with your local zoning regulation. So depending on the city, this is almost universal in the U.S., but there's zoning and really is broken into two parts. There's either a max square footage or a max units allowed. So you'll have to check with your city first, and then you want to look at sort of what the cost to build is. But say you've got a bigger lot and you're approved to add a detached garage and build an apartment above it, or you can do that sort of pool house, even if you don't have the pool, you sort of call it that pool house. That little outbuilding, you can have it as this like guest suite. So there's definitely options out there. You just got to check with your local zoning and building department first to see if it's doable. But we got a guy that I'm getting ready to interview for my podcast. That's all he does is build those accessory dwelling units. And he's been doing them on his own home. So he's a contractor that builds them for other folks. And then he always does it in every home he lives in, specifically as a way to, one, he can build it cheap because he's a contractor, but as a way to always offset his mortgage. And I just think it's a really cool and brilliant strategy if you got that extra space on your property.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about for someone who already owns that home, but they're like, I don't want to take another mortgage and buy another property and have to pay the property taxes. I'm already doing that here. Is there a way I could sort of transform what I already have and then make it accessible to have another tenant on the property, whether it's maybe building in that in-law suite or maybe closing off the basement and putting some stairs going there to keep my privacy?
If you got space, I think that accessory dwelling unit is probably one of the most beautiful strategies because it can change with you through your whole life, right? So, you know, you got your nice single family home, you got the land. So say you've got the kids. Now you're living in the single family home. You have that garage apartment, ADU, that you rent out. So now it is all of a sudden helping offset your mortgage costs. So while you're raising your family, you're having your good life, those housing costs are extremely low. Now you've got that moody teenager, right? Well, we're going to go put him up in the guest house, or your kids are going off to college locally. Well, they don't want to be home with mom and dad, but we're going to have them have cheap housing. So now they can have their own little apartment out back. And then they can live there when they're a young professional and move out. Now, as our parents are getting older, but you know they don't want to be under the same roof of us, now the parent can move into that ADU. So this ADU style of house hacking could literally, you know, carry you over a generation if you're in that single family home that you love and you don't want to give up. So it's a really cool strategy that can change with you throughout life.
And I was that moody teenager. Tony, you remember this. My grandma, as I told you, I had the in-law suite and she passed away. And once that happened, I was right about going into high school. My parents said, there you go, that's your spot. And all my buddies would come over there. We play video games. We had the whole place to ourselves. We had a kitchen full of Sprite, what was my beverage of choice at the time. And it was great. And so that was definitely a great option.
Yeah, some good times there. And Andrew, I wanted to ask you, I'm not sure if you would know specifically about pricing for this, but if someone does own a home and they're looking to maybe add some sort of ADU suite or something like that to their property, I know you mentioned you're having a guy on your podcast who specifically kind of builds these types of units for people. Do you know what like a cost would be or an approximate cost would be if someone was looking to add like an addition like that to their home?
It's really going to vary on the cost of country. So it's probably three times as much to do it in, say, San Francisco, California versus here in New Orleans. What I'd say is you want to look at your return on investment, right? So you could look at cost to build new in your area, and you should be able to find that pretty easily. So just Google, you know, cost to build a new home, New Orleans, cost to build a new home, Colorado, and you should be able to find like a per square foot cost. So $200 a square foot, $100 a square foot, $500, whatever. And then say, all right, if we're building this 800 square foot apartment above a garage, and then you can sort of figure out, maybe it's going to cost us $100,000 to build this ADU. What would my mortgage be if maybe you get a HELOC or a second mortgage to cover that and say, great, all right, so my 10-year loan for that $100,000 is going to be $400 a month. Oh, I can rent that for $1,000 a month. There's $600 spread in there. So you know you've got that option. Or maybe, you know, you're just financially well off and you're saying, okay, you know, we inherited money. I'm going to put this $100,000 somewhere. We want to build an ADU. You know, so that same scenario of, all right, we can rent it out for $1,000 a month, $1,000 a month. That's $12,000 a year. You know, back out a little for maintenance and costs for that ADU. So maybe you're at $8,000. That $8,000 into that $100,000 is an 8% return per year. That's not counting potential appreciation on the property and all that other stuff. So just sort of look at a cost to build, what your return would be, whether you're using cash or you're getting financing for it.
And I would even say to add to that too, is well, you could also probably guess build it yourself if you don't want to, you know, outsource that. If you are handy and you want a side project or a home improvement project, maybe take a year, take two, and just as you have that money coming in for your paycheck, set a little bit aside and do a little bit work here and there. If that's something that you do enjoy and you are skilled in that. And the other thing I was thinking about, we're talking about these units. What about if you don't want to commit right away? Or maybe this is great if you already have one of these units, but you were that privacy issue of having a tenant there all the time. But how about Airbnb? that could be a way to sort of test that out, where you're not committing to somebody who's in a year-long contract, but maybe you can do a month, run it out for a month, or just a couple days on the weekend or whatnot, just to see how that sort of feels. Do you advise or do you talk about Airbnb?
Yeah, so, you know, there's those six main styles of house hacking. What I talk a lot about is on the show and in that ultimate guide to house hacking is there's sort of three types of tenant bases. So there's the short-term tenant, you know, folks that will stay a couple nights to say 30 days. So that's, you know, think about like Airbnb, VRBO, that really short-term rental, right? So you want to make sure you're in a place where folks are going to be coming to town for whatever reason. And then that sort of next is this midterm tenant. And this is this sort of, with both the short-term and midterm, you usually need to furnish the place. But the midterm, think about like travel nurses. So there's nurses that will come and take contracts for on average 10 to 13 weeks. They'll come and they'll work with a local hospital. They get paid really great and they need a furnished place to stay for that period of time. I mean, just think about how cool it could be. I mean, if you're going to have a tenant, I mean, a nurse is screened. They have background check done. They're licensed. They're medically trained. I mean, if you ever want a tenant on your property, that could be a pretty good tenant to have, right? And then there's a lot of folks that will do corporate housing, where they'll rent out their place for 3 to 6 months, where an executive's coming to town and they don't want to stay in a hotel for 3 months or 6 months at a time. So they want a nice furnished place that feels more like a home. So that's that sort of midterm tenant. And then there's the traditional long-term tenant where folks, you know, they do a year lease at a time. So you can really look at what is the style of house hacking that fits best where I'm at and what's the type of tenant base that I think I'm most comfortable with. And you compare that with whatever's going to fit. So Airbnb, that short term, or that travel nurse corporate housing, or the traditional long term tenant. So yeah, it's a great way to just test things out and figure out what's going to work out well for you.
And that's perfect because you actually covered the next question. If we're looking at the steps, you know, we talked about finding the property, what types of property there are available to us and what we can use. Running the numbers, talked about the 1% rule. Securing finance, we talked about that as well. The different loan options that we have. Closing on the property once you decide to make that decision. And then the next one is finding the right tenants. And you just sort of cover that is what types of tenants are there out there. Is there anything that you would use or maybe you suggest if it is going to be a long-term stay, how would you screen those tenants? And sort of like, what does that process look like? If I wanted to advertise this property, am I using Craigslist or am I just putting some ads in the paper? And then there's certain guidelines when I'm interviewing somebody to apply like that towards. How does that work? And you have to have a certain many of applicants and what does that interview sort of look like?
Yeah. You know, the great thing with a short-term rental is there's sort of that built-in screening, right? You know, they've got the review system in Airbnb and VRBO, and then they have that insurance. So when you start to do that midterm to long-term rental, you want to do tenant screening. So first you got to get tenants in, you got to market. So I love Furnish Finder for listing furnished places to travel nurses, corporate housing. You can also list stuff on like Facebook Marketplace. When you get to the long-term tenants, I take a volume approach. So you could post on Craigslist. I mean, Facebook Marketplace has been turned into such a go-to for listing places. And then I'll do a lot of things like Realtor, Zillow, Trulia. You can list your place on apartment.com. They've actually broadened their scope outside of just listing apartments. So I like to list as many places I can that are free or close to free. That way I'm getting as many applicants as possible. So write a great description, have really great photos, and then you'll get a lot of applicants. You show them the place and then get them to apply. And there's a lot of different screening options out there where you can do, but what you should be doing is a background check, you know, making sure they're seeing their criminal record, if it's there or not there. And then also looking at their credit. People don't need to have perfect credit, but we want to make sure they're, you know, not getting evicted from someplace else, or everything is, you know, they haven't paid their credit card, their car's about to get repoed, whatever it is. And then you sort of do that screening to get them to apply.
For the background check and the credit, is that something that I grab their information, social security, name, and then I'm paying somebody else to do that to get those results back? Or is it something that I have them bring me?
Yeah, so you should manage the process, but I tried to avoid taking any personal information like that. So I love using tools like Cozy or Avail, their property management sort of softwares for that sort of small to everyday landlord. So whether you're just going to house hack or you've got a couple properties, Cozy and Avail are a great option. So with Cozy, I can create the listing and I can create the application. I send the link to the tenants apply, the tenants pay for the background screening, and then Cozy sends me the result. So I don't have to collect the social security number and date of birth, but Cozy will say, hey, here's their credit and here is their background check. And then we can review it that way. And it's putting the onus on the tenant to apply and pay for that. And that keeps our costs as landlords or house hackers low.
And I saw, Tony, you were jotting some things down. We could add that to the show notes as well, some of those resources on there for someone who's interested and potentially, obviously now house hacking after listening to this, that they could pull some of those resources to find those websites.
And, you know, Furnish Finder that I mentioned earlier, they actually is a great place to find travel nurses. They actually built into their back end of their site a tenant screening option as well. So when you're having those travel nurses apply, you can still do your own screening right there through Furnish Finder. So yeah, definitely use those services that are out there to help you. And then the last big thing is, even if they're your friend, sign a lease, right? So everyone should get screening on them, even if they're your friend, but then have everyone sign a lease, whether it's they're renting a room, they're renting, you know, the walkout basement, that apartment above the garage, whatever it is, have them sign a lease. And don't just go download a free lease or ask your friend for a copy of a lease. Go get a lease that is set up for your state and your local municipality, because there's going to be different regulations in Colorado versus California or say New Orleans or North Carolina. And the place that I've been using for probably almost a decade now, maybe 9 years, is Easy Landlord Forms. You know, they got a team of lawyers that build out all the forms. You know, when you set up a new lease, it costs like $20 or $30, and then you're good to go, and you create that lease, and that lease is set up for your state and your local county or parish. And that's really going to help protect you in the worst case something goes wrong.
Yeah, I absolutely love the process that you mentioned with Cozy and Avail, because that really takes like a lot of the insecurity away from me. Like if I'm thinking about renting something out to someone, I don't want their personal information. I don't have to worry about like meeting regulation guidelines for storing that and having that on file and stuff like that. You know, using Cozy and Avail seems like it would be like a great resource to kind of take that responsibility away from the actual landlord.
That is so helpful, because I think, you know, just going through this, some of the things that I didn't even think about, one was, how do I screen tenants? And I think if somebody has a property like this, or if they just thought about real estate investing in general, just I'm going to buy a property to rent it out, you still have to screen tenants. So these are great resources for that. And then the second thing is creating that contract, creating that lease. I had no clue, do I write it on my own? Do I have to pay a lawyer? But here's another good tool where you're saying somebody can craft this, you're paying it, and you have something in writing. So two answers to some of the questions that I had, and I'm sure a lot of other people had those questions as well.
It sounds intimidating up front, right? It's like, oh, I'm all of a sudden gonna be a landlord. I'm gonna have to rent out a room or this extra space where I'm living. In reality, it's a complicated process, but you can get these shortcuts by using something like Cozy and Avail to help on the property management side for the screening. Cozy and Avail also helps with rent collection. So now you don't have to go pick up cash or a check. The tenants can go and pay right on Cozy and does the ACH draft for you, or they can pay via credit card. And then, you know, use a tool like Easy Landlord Form, where they've got the army of lawyers that are building that stuff. And the thing I love about the Easy Landlord Forms, and this isn't, they don't pay me, it's no sponsor, I just really love them, right? When you're walking through it, it helps you. It says, hey, there's no requirement in your state, but here's what the average person does. Or your state, your county requires this. And it just helps walk you through that. And if you're trying to fumble that on your own, it can seem very intimidating. But, you know, use these shortcuts, use these tools that some are free, some might cost you a little bit of money, but it's going to save you a lot of headache and heartache and stress and worry. And then they're great protections. And this is the thing about being a landlord, right? Is you want to sort of hedge your bet. You want to put firewalls around things and just essentially protect yourself in a worst case scenario. 99% of the time, it's fine. We just want to do these steps to protect us for that potentially worst case scenario.
The last two things that I did have on this list when we're talking about these steps after we found those tenants is just maintaining the property and then watching your savings grow. And when you're maintaining that property, is there a number? I know when I was diving into some real estate investing, there is a CapEx, your major expenditures. Is there something that you should sort of embed into your 1% formula of I should probably be saving X amount towards renovations or updates on the property?
Yeah, so there's sort of two rule of thumb. So one is, and this is maybe more on the traditional homeowner side, you know, you should be putting away or building a little savings reserve or nest egg. And I just did air quotes, realize y'all can't see that, 2% of the home's value. So if you're in a $100,000 home, for easy math, you know, you should try to be building up about $2,000 a year. And that would be to help cover maintenance. So, you know, the fridge breaks, that could be, you know, some fridges now are crazy, like $2,000-$3,000, or the stove breaks or the HVAC goes out, you know, maintenance stuff. And then what you had mentioned, CapEx, is this idea of, hey, the roof's brand new now, but it's going to need a new roof in 20 years. And that's going to cost $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. So I should be putting aside a little bit every month. So, well, that one rule of thumb says 2% of the home value. And then the other side is put aside a percentage of your gross collected rent. So say you're in a two-unit property, a duplex, you're living in one side, it should, the side you're in should rent out, say, $1,000 a month, and the other side rents out $1,000 a month. So the gross rents on that property would be $2,000 a month. You should set aside 5 to 10% for maintenance and 5 to 10% for CapEx. And that CapEx are those big things like the roof needs to be replaced in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, or the house needs to be repainted. And again, those are just broad rules of thumbs to help give you an idea. The biggest thing is you should be setting aside money. Even if you're not going to house hack or invest in real estate, you still should be setting aside money for those property repairs and big things that are going to come up.
And I think a big thing to help anyone out is just spreadsheets. Have a document, list this in there so you could actually see these numbers, because we're talking and talking, you're trying to grasp all these and it could be confusing and there's a lot of information. But if you started with a spreadsheet and just started to write those out, what is my mortgage payment? What is the rent that I'm getting from the tenant? What is my savings? Okay, it's X amount a month. It will look more compact and more simplistic once you have that out. And online, they have a bunch of spreadsheets for you to do that if you just start Googling.
You know, even if you use Mint, I know Mint is really big in the personal finance space. You can set up saving goals in Mint. So set up a savings goal for property reserves and property maintenance, and then Mint will check and say, hey, you know, you should have been putting aside X amount every single month. So, you know, there's a lot of options out there.
And then, as I mentioned just before, the last thing is just watch your savings grow. So once you have something like that, in a perfect world, you are just saving money and that's going towards whatever goal it is that you have determined it to be. And those steps are listed in your house hacking guide that we're going to have listed on there as well, to just run through that again. I want to talk about one more thing before I sort of open it up to you. I did see that you have handled some evictions. So worst case scenario is that eviction. What is that process like? Do you have to get lawyers involved? Is there special things that you need to do for that?
Yeah, so it's going to vary slightly from, you know, county to county, state to state. So I'll sort of speak in broad terms. I guess let me add the caveat too, so folks don't get worried. Like, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to deal with evictions. 99% of the time, it is fine. I've invested in college housing, affordable housing, and then sort of mid-level, upper-level, nicer housing. I've never had to do evictions in any sort of demographic except for the affordable housing. And most of the time, that was tenants that I inherited when I bought property. So I'll add that disclaimer first. But yeah, I think over my affordable housing, those several years I did that, 20 plus evictions I handled. These were very horrible tenants, people that knew how to work the system. But because I had really tight leases and I made them sign the leases, made sure they understood it, and I enforce the rules in the leases, basically that most folks, if they break a lease, you got to serve a notice that they're in violation of the lease, and then they have a period that they have to rectify it. And then if they don't, you can then go file a court. If there's a tenant doesn't pay, depending on the state, there's a grace period. And then you have to deliver what is called like a pay or quit notice. The terminology varies from state to state, but the idea is, all right, so, you know, Rich, if you're my tenant, and you don't pay on the first, my state says I got to give you a, say, 3-day grace period. So if you haven't paid by the third, on the fourth, I'm emailing you and I'm leaving on your door a pay or quit notice. The pay or quit notice range varies from state to state. So, you know, maybe your state is 10 days. So I'm delivering on day number four, that grace period is up, that pay or quit that says, Rich, if you don't pay in 10 days, then we're done. I'm filing in court. As soon as that period's over, you then go file in court for a court date. And then depending on your state, you can represent yourself because it's a sort of small claims eviction. And then some states you can hire a lawyer. If you've never gone through the process before, I'd say spend the $300-$500 to hire a lawyer just to help you through it. I was very comfortable in a court setting and I knew I had great leases. So I represented myself. I won every single eviction except for one. And I actually technically won. They appealed. And then we had to go to the appellate court. And then I won again there. It just, the tenant felt like fighting and wanted to try to buy a little more time. They ended up losing. And then I got a judgment against them. But, you know, if you have good leases and then go hire a lawyer, they'll take care of it. It'll cost you a little bit of money, but it helps with that peace of mind. So that's sort of a long explanation there for you.
Once again, I love the fact that the disclaimer was 99% of the time it's going to work out. And this is for that 1%. And in your case scenario, these are all the tenants that you inherited. And so if you are having a good, thorough screening process, hopefully this won't be an issue for you. And maybe it's even 99.9% of the time it's going to work out fine.
Yeah, if you're a good landlord, you take care of your place, you treat people well, most folks are going to, you know, they're not going to want to be friends with you and you don't want to be friends with them because you're a tenant. You want to keep it a business relationship. But I like to be more optimistic, right? Most folks like to be decent people. And if you're giving them a decent place to live and you're fixing stuff when it breaks, they're going to say, okay, well, I'm actually living here and you're fixing stuff, so I owe you rent. And 99% of the time, you won't really ever have issues. And then you make sure to have ironclad leases for that small percent of the time when it doesn't work out well.
Now, that sort of concludes the information that we had on there. I want to ask you if there's anything else that you want to add in addition to what we've talked about so far.
Yeah, so don't be like me when I was 20 and blowing all my money when I was doing house hacking. So don't make that mistake. So when you start to save that $500,000 a month from house hacking, you know, use it to pay down debt, max out your IRA or your 401k to help get you ahead financially.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us on our show today. It was a pleasure to have you on. And we are also excited. We don't get to let you go just yet. You're going to be joining us for our beer review.
You know, this was the whole reason why I agreed to do the show, right? Just so we could have the beer at the end.
Yeah, it wasn't about the house hacking. It was the beer at the end. So we'll go ahead and splash right into that in a second.
Awesome.
Now let's splash right into Rich and Tony's beer review. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok now. But most importantly, budgetsandbrews.com. Yes, we have our own website. If you go to the website, we're going to have all of our podcasts. We have financial articles that we're posting weekly. We got our beer review section, and we also have our merch store. And if you don't want to pay for it, that's okay. We give it away for free on our Facebook page. So every month, go ahead and check that out, and we're going to be giving away raffles for our hats and shirts and sweatshirts. Once again, our beer reviews mean nothing since we don't know what we're talking about. Please use our lack of knowledge for your entertainment. Tony, what's on tap this week?
For this week's beer, we'll be reviewing Blue Moon Belgium White. Remember, we use a scale of 1 to 100, 1 being the worst beer we've ever tasted and 100 being the best.
And I am definitely excited to try this one. This is one of my favorites. I've had it before. It's going to be different now. It's going from a bottle, pouring it in a glass, yeah. Not on draft. So I know, Tony, you got the can.
And it looks pretty good over here. It's like a white can with a blue backdrop, and it's got the Blue Moon logo on it. Looks like a blue moon. It says Blue Moon on it, and Belgium White. Looking pretty good.
5.4% alcohol. We'll go ahead and go with the pour and head retention.
All right, let's get it.
Go ahead and crack these open.
Ooh, that's a nice Ooh. Crack.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's some nice crack right there. Mm-hmm. See, get it right nice and close to the mic for you.
We'll be pouring at a 45-degree angle here, and once it gets about halfway, then you turn it upright.
Yeah, we have no clue if that's actually what you do, but that's what we've been doing every episode, about 45-degree
yep. Sounds pretty good.
Angle. Okay. Yep, and then yeah. It sounds like we
wow,
think we know
what
we're doing.
Good head on this beer, though.
I must have did it wrong, or mine's a little flat, because I've got no head at all. So mine could be a little skunked.
Oh, you know, yours is
very
nothing, no bubbles,
well,
nothing
is,
at all.
Is it cold, right? Because I think cold has to do with the carbonation and the head retention. So mine was ice cold. I have a chilled mug, too. And my pour looks pretty good. So out of 15, there's a lot. Yeah, there's
yours
a
little,
looks
a little overdone.
Maybe 3 inches ahead, and it's sticking around, too. So I'll give it an 8 out of 15.
Well, I'm gonna, folks can't obviously see this, but you know, Tony's is like way too much head. I got nothing. And then Rich is here with just about the right amount, I'd say.
And I would say it's also the first time, I don't think I've ever had a clean pour. It's usually nothing. It's exactly like you have, Andrew. It's every single time, it's just like dull. This time I actually had a decent, I would say about an inch and a half, maybe two, and then it just sort of withered right down and I got some bubbles just floating right on top. This was a great pour for me. Out of 15, I'm going to give this a 13. Like, this was pretty solid for me.
You know,
how about you, Andrew?
I'm going to say probably a 7, but there's a lot of human error in that. So we'll just say that if you're an experienced pourer, you probably could get it to a 13 or 14, but I'll give it a 7.
And just once again, it was hilarious though. Like, no one can see this at home, but Anthony's is still all the way foamed up. Like, it is not, he's got a good, like, 4 inches of strength.
Good, though. I mean, it's probably a little bit too much, but it's getting there. It's coming down.
I don't know how you're going to smell it with all those bubbles. All right, well, diving into the appearance and color. And so this one is out of 10. Mine is very cloudy. Mm-hmm. It is not clear at all. I'm trying to hold it up to some light here. If there are bubbles floating up, I can't see them because there's just that much cloud. It looks orangish, yellowish, but just really, really cloudy. So I'm going to go for my appearance, but maybe this is how it's supposed to look. I don't know. But I'm going to give it, I'll give it a 6.
I'm looking at this too. It's very, very cloudy, very dense beer. You definitely can't see through it. You can put your hand behind it. It kind of just looks like a shadow as you look through it. But I do see some bubbles coming up, and it looks like a very light color beer to me, like a lighter yellow. I'm not used to beers looking this color. But so it doesn't look too appetizing. I'm going to give it a 5.
Ooh, man. All right. So I guess you guys don't like the Belgian beer. So as someone that loves some Belgian beers, they're like, this is yellow, this is orange. I'm going to tell you how it is. This is a beautiful, nice, thick, golden yellow orange wheat ale. And I've got some nice bubbles coming up just on the edge. Looks absolutely delicious. I'm going to give this a 9 out of a 10.
I was thinking that. Like, you used good descriptors, but yes, that's what this is. It's nice, sort of like a thick, it looks like there's stuff like dancing in there, like clouds of foam, just the clouds, sort of dancing clouds. Let's move on to the smell. The smell's out of 20.
Get them noses, I'm excited in there. For this. Don't be afraid to get a little wet.
Yes, that is great.
That's actually kind of nice, huh?
It smells like prime time oranges. Like, I just love the strong
fruit, orange aroma. Citrus aroma right on the top. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm smelling as well. That citrus aroma. I have to get really close though. It's not overbearing. You got to, maybe that's
too much foam.
It actually dried
there.
Down. It's about a half inch now. It's looking good, but I got to get my nose really close. Yeah. And
it's like a hint of maybe some, I don't know, like barley or hops, but like so subtle. Like on a scale of 1 to 10 for the barley, maybe like a 2, but it's there. And then the rest of it, it's that citrus, powerful orange peel. It smells great. So for me, out of 20, I'm giving this an 18.
Oh, I'm going to be right there with you, that 18. You get a little bit of the barley, but the citrus, and it's just really, really subtle where, you know, if you're sitting at the table and someone doesn't like beer, they're not going to get the like overpowering smell of it. You just got to get really close and then you get that citrusy. So yeah, I'll give it an 18 as well.
I agree. I think it's not overpowering. This isn't like a beer that you're going to smell and it's going to blow you away, which I think works against it a little bit. Out of 20, I will give it a 15.
So now is our favorite part. So it's the taste. All right. And this is going to be out of 30. Up. So I'm excited. Cheers.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So good when it hits the lips.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm going in for seconds.
It's got a good taste. It tastes, for me, it's pretty drinkable. I don't really drink a lot of Belgian whites, so it's a little bit foreign to me, but it tastes okay. Would you guys say it's like a little bit tart? Is that what I'm getting? I don't know. I feel like Belgian whites normally come with like an orange peel on top to give it a little bit of that sweetness, a little slice of orange or a garnish. Out of 30 for the taste on my end, I'm going to give it a 22.
I enjoy this. I love this. It tastes, you taste the orange. You taste like a thickness. Like it's not just like a Miller Lite, like almost a water based. It's a little more thick, got some muscle behind it, and maybe syrupy, but in a nice syrupy way. Like a really lean, like if the syrup was on a workout, it's performing for a bodybuilding competition. It's a lean syrup. Orange citrus sort of taste. I enjoyed it. Out of 30, I'm going to go 24.
I mean, being that I love Belgian beers, I'm going to give it a 28 out of a 30. So pretty good. Pretty nice.
And now the aftertaste.
All right,
for 25.
I was going to say, I got to get back in there, get that fresh aftertaste in my mouth.
It is a very pleasant aftertaste. But it's not like it's burning your throat. It's not like it's a high volume of alcohol.
Yeah.
It just hangs out there. It lingers a little bit, gives you a little fruit, almost like if you had like a Trident gum and it was orange and you chewed it for 3-4 seconds of chewing, then all of a sudden that orangey gum hits you. So I really liked it. It was enjoyable. And it just it hangs out for a little bit and just subtly fades and you don't even know it's gone. I'm going to go out of 25. I'm giving this a 22.
Yeah, I agree. I really like the aftertaste of this. I feel like my mouth tastes better after I take a sip than it did previously. So it's a very subtle taste, but you get a little bit of that orange, that citrusiness towards the end of it. I'll give it a 22 or 21.
I'm going to go the 24 out of 25. Just a big fan. I really like it. Great initial taste, great aftertaste. Leaves me wanting to keep drinking it. So 24 out of 25 for me.
All right, and so for the overall rankings, I am giving this, adding this up, a 83 out of 100.
All right, and I thought it was pretty good. I gave it a 71 out of 100.
Awesome, and my final score came back at an 86 out of 100.
And that wraps up episode number 17. And if you enjoyed listening, we ask that you give it a thumbs up, subscribe, or follow. And oh yeah, please share this episode with family and friends if you found it beneficial. Also, don't forget to leave a review and comment on what topics you want us to cover for the next upcoming weeks. That does it. See ya.